he could will it as he would a limb to move for him. The only exception was blood. Though it flowed as readily as the rest, blood itself did not obey the laws of elements. It could not be manipulated, told to move, or forced to still. Blood had a will of its own, and had to be addressed not as an object, but as an equal, an adversary. Which was why Antari stood apart. For they alone held dominion not only over elements, but also over blood. Where elemental invocation was designed simply to help the mind focus to find a personal synchronicity with the magic, it was meditative, a chant as much as a summoning. The Antari blood commands were, as the term suggested, commands. The words Kell spoke to open doors or heal wounds with his blood were orders, and they had to be given in order to be obeyed. "What's it like?" asked Rye out of nowhere. Kell dragged his attention away from the glass, but the water kept spinning inside it.
"What's what like?"
"Being able to travel, to see the other Londons. What are they like?"
Kell hesitated. A scrying table sat against one wall. Unlike the smooth black panels of slate that broadcast messages throughout the city, the table served a different purpose. Instead of stone, it held a shallow pool of still water, enchanted to project one's ideas, memories, images from their mind onto the surface of the water. It was used for reflection, yes, but also to share one's thoughts with others, to help when words failed to convey or simply fell short. With the table, Kell could show him. Let Rye see the other Londons as he saw them. A selfish part of Kell wanted to share them with his brother so that he wouldn't feel so alone, so that someone else would see, would know. But the thing about people, Kell had discovered, is that they didn't really want to know. They thought they did, but knowing only made them miserable. Why fill up a mind with things you can't use? Why dwell on places you can't go? What good would it do Rye, who, for all the privileges his royal status might grant him, could never set foot in another London?
"Uneventful," said Kell, returning his glass to the chest.
As soon as his fingers left its surface, the cyclone fell apart, the water sloshing and settling to a stop. Before Rye could ask any more questions, Kell pointed at the glass in the prince's hand and told him to try again. Rye tried again, and failed again to move the earth within the glass. He made a frustrated noise and knocked the sphere away across the table.
"I'm rubbish at this, and we both know it."
Kell caught the glass ball as it reached the table's edge and tumbled over.
"Practice," he started. "Practice won't do a damn thing."
"Your problem, Rye," chided Kell, "is that you don't want to learn magic to learn magic. You only want to learn it because you think it will help you lure people into your bed." Rye's lips twitched.
"I don't see how there's a problem," he said.
"And it would.
I've seen the way girls and boys fawn over your pretty black eye, Kell."
He shoved to his feet.
"Forget the lesson. I'm in no mood for learning. Let's go out."
"Why?" asked Kell.
"So you can use my magic to lure people into your bed."
"A fine idea," said Rye. "But no, we must go out, you see, because we're on a mission."
"Oh?" asked Kell.
"Yes, because unless you plan to wed me yourself, and don't get me wrong, I think we make a dashing pair, I must try and find a mate."
"And you think you'll find one traipsing around the city?"
"Goodness, no," said Rye with a crooked grin. "But who knows what fun I'll find while failing."
Kell rolled his eyes and put the orbs away.
"Moving on," he said.
"Let's be done with this," whined Rye.
"We shall be done," said Kell, "as soon as you can contain a flame."
Of all the elements, fire was the only one Rye had shown a, well, talent was too strong a word, but perhaps an ability for. Kel cleared the wooden table and set a sloped metal dish before the prince, along with a piece of white chalk, a vial of oil, and an odd little device like a pair of crossed pieces of blackened wood, joined by a hinge in the middle. Rai sighed and drew a binding circle on the table around the dish using the chalk. He then emptied the vial onto the plate, the oil pooling in the centre, no bigger than a 10-lin coin. Finally, he lifted the device, which fit easily in his palm. It was a fire starter. When Rai closed his hand around it and squeezed, the two stems scraped together and a spark fell from the hinge to the pool of oil and caught. A small blue flame danced across the surface of the coin-sized pool, and Rai cracked his knuckles, rolled his neck, and pushed up his sleeves. "Before the light goes out," urged Kel. Rai shot him a look, but brought his hands to either side of the chalk-binding circle, palms in, and began to speak to the fire, not in English, but in Arnesian. It was a more fluid, coaxing tongue that lent itself to magic. The words poured out in a whisper, a smooth, unbroken line of sound that seemed to take shape in the room around them. And to both of their amazement, it worked. The flame in the dish turned white and grew, enveloping what was left of the oil and continuing to burn without it. It spread, coating the surface of the plate and flaring up into the air before Rai's face.
"Look!"
said Rai, pointing at the light.
"Look! I did it!"
And he had. But even though he'd stopped speaking to the flame, it kept growing.
"Don't lose focus," said Kel as the white fire spread, licking the edges of the chalk circle.
"What?"
challenged Rai as the fire twisted and pressed against the binding ring.
"No word of praise?"
He looked away from the fire and toward Kel, his fingers brushing along the table as he turned.
"Not even a—"
"Rai!"
warned Kel, but it was too late. Rai's hand had skimmed the circle, smudging the line of chalk. The fire tore free. It flared up across the table, sudden and hot, and Rai nearly toppled backward in his chair, trying to get out of its way. In a single motion, Kel had freed his knife, drawn it across his palm, and pressed his bloodied hand to the tabletop.
"As Anasai,"
he ordered. "Dispel." The enchanted fire died instantly, vanishing into air. Kel's head spun. Rai stood there breathless.
"I'm sorry," he said guiltily. "I'm sorry. I shouldn't have—"
Rai hated it when Kel was forced to use blood magic, because he felt personally responsible. He often was, for the sacrifice that came with it. He had caused Kel a great deal of pain once and had never quite forgiven himself for it. Now Kel took up a cloth and wiped his wounded hand.
"It's fine," he said, tossing aside the rag. "I'm fine. But I think we're done for today."
Rai nodded shakily.
"I could use another drink," he said. "Something strong."
"Agreed," said Kel with a tired smile.
"Hey, we haven't been to the Arvindstrasse in ages," said Rai.
"We can't go there," said Kel.
What he meant was, "I can't let you go there." Despite its name, the Arvindstrasse, Blessed Waters, had become a haunt for the city's unsavory sorts.
"Come on,"
said Rai, already returned to his sporting self.
"We'll get Parrish and Jen to dig up some uniforms, and we'll all go as—"
Just then, a man cleared his throat, and Rai and Kel both turned to find King Maxim standing in the doorway.
"Sir,"
they said in unison.
"Boys," he said, "how are your studies going?"
Rai gave Kel a weighted look, and Kel raised a brow, but said only,
"They've come and gone. We just finished."
"Good,"
said the king, producing a letter. Kel didn't realize how much he badly wanted that drink with Rai until he saw the envelope and he knew he wouldn't get it. His heart sank, but he didn't let it show.
"I need you to carry a message," said the king, "to our strong neighbour."
Kell's chest tightened with the familiar mixture of fear and excitement that was inextricable when it came to White London.
"Of course, sir," he said. "Holland delivered a letter yesterday," explained the king, "but couldn't stay to collect the response. I told him I would send it back with you."
Kell frowned.
"All is well, I hope," he said carefully.
He rarely knew the contents of the royal messages he carried, but he could usually glean the tone. The correspondences with Grey London had devolved to mere formality, the cities having little in common. While the dialogue with White was constant and involved and left a furrow in the king's brow. Their strong neighbour, as the king called the other city, was a place torn by violence and power, the name at the end of the royal letters changing with disturbing frequency. It would have been too easy to discontinue correspondence and leave White London to its decay, but the Red Crown couldn't. Wouldn't. They felt responsible for the dying city. And they were. After all, it had been Red London's decision to seal itself off, leaving White London, which sat between red and black, trapped, and forced to fight back the dark plague on its own, to seal itself in, and the corrupted magic out. It was a decision that haunted centuries of kings and queens, but at the time White London was strong, stronger even than Red, and the Red Crown believed, or claimed to believe, it was the only way they would all survive. They were right and wrong. Grey London receded into quiet obliviousness. Red not only survived, but flourished. But White was forever changed. The city, once glorious, fell to chaos and conquering, blood and ash.
"All is as well as it can be," said the king as he handed Kell the note and turned back toward the door.
Kell moved to follow when Rye caught his arm.
"Promise!"
the prince whispered under his breath.
"Promise you'll come back empty-handed this time."
Kell hesitated.
"I promise,"
he said, wondering how many times he had said those words, how empty they'd become. But as he pulled a pale piece of silver from beneath his collar, he hoped that this time they might prove true. 2. Kell stepped through the door in the world and shivered. Red London had vanished, taking the warmth with it. His boots hit cold stone, and his breath blossomed in the air before his lips, and he pulled his coat, the black one with the silver buttons, tightly around his shoulders.
"Priste ir essen. Essen ir priste."
Power in balance, balance in power. Equal parts motto, mantra and prayer, the words ran beneath the royal emblem in Red London and could be found in shops and homes alike. People in Kell's world believed that magic was neither an infinite resource nor a base one. It was meant to be used but not abused, wielded with reverence as well as caution. White London had a very different notion. Here, magic was not seen as equal. It was seen as something to be conquered, enslaved, controlled. Black London had let magic in, let it take over, let it consume. In the wake of the city's fall, White London had taken the opposite approach, seeking to bind power in any way they could. Power in balance became power in dominance. And when the people fought to control the magic resisted them, shrank away into itself, burrowed down into the earth and out of reach. The people clawed the surface of the world, digging up what little magic they could still grasp, but it was thin, and only growing thinner, as were those fighting for it. The magic seemed determined to starve its captors out. But slowly, surely, it was succeeding. This struggle had a side effect, and that effect was the reason Kell had named White London White. Every inch of the city, day or night, summer or winter, bore the same pall, as though a fine coat of snow or ash had settled over everything. And every one. The magic here was bitter and mean, and it bled the world's life and warmth and colour, leeching it out of everything and leaving only the pale and bloated corpse behind. Kell looped the white London coin, a weighty iron thing, around his neck and tucked it back beneath his collar. The crisp blackness of his coat made him stand out against the faded backdrop of the city streets, and he shoved his blood-streaked hand into his pocket before the rich red sight of it gave anyone ideas. The pearl-toned surface of the half-frozen river, here called neither the Thames nor the Isle, but the Sealt, stretched at his back, and across it the north side of the city reached to the horizon. In front of him the south side waited, and several blocks ahead the castle lunged into the air with knife-like spires, its stone mass dwarfing the buildings on every side. He didn't waste time, but made his way directly toward it. Being lanky, Kell had a habit of slouching, but walking through the streets of White London he pulled himself to his full height and kept his chin up and his shoulders back as his boots echoed on the cobblestones. His posture wasn't the only thing that changed. At home, Kell masked his power. Here, he knew better. He let his magic fill the air, and the starving air ate it up, warming against his skin, wicking off in tendrils of fog. It was a fine line to walk. He had to show his strength while still holding fast to it. Too little, and he'd be seen as prey. Too much, and he'd be seen as a prize. In theory, the people of the city knew Kell, or of him, and knew that he was under the protection of the White Crown. And in theory, no one would be foolish enough to defy the Dane twins. But hunger, for energy, for life, did things to people. Made them do things. And so Kell kept his guard up and watched the sinking sun as he walked, knowing that White London was at its most docile in the light of day. The city changed at night. The quiet, an unnatural, heavy, held-breath kind of silence broke and gave way to noise, sounds of laughter, of passion. Some thought it a way to summon power, but mostly those of fighting and killing. A city of extremes, thrilling maybe, but deadly. The streets would have been stained dark with blood long ago if the cutthroats didn't drink it all. With the sun still up, the lowly and the lost lingered in doorways and hung out of windows and loitered in the gaps between buildings. And all of them watched Kell as he passed, gaunt stairs and bony edges. Their clothes had the same faded quality as the rest of the city. So did their hair, their eyes, and their skin, the surface of which was covered in markings, brands and scars, mutilations meant to bind what magic they could summon to their bodies. The weaker they were, the more scars they made on themselves, ruining their flesh in a frantic attempt to hold on to what little power they had. In Red London, such markings would be seen as base, tainting not only body but also magic by binding it to them. Here only the strong could afford to scorn the marks, and even then they did not see them as defiling, merely desperate. But even those above such brands relied on amulets and charms. Holland alone went without any jewellery, save the brooch that marked him as a servant of the throne. Magic did not come willingly here. The language of elements had been abandoned when they ceased to listen. The only element that could be summoned was a perverted kind of energy, a bastard of fire and something darker, corrupted. What magic could be had was taken, forced into shape by amulets and spells and bindings. It was never enough, never filling. But the people did not leave. The power of the Sealt, even in its half-frozen state, tethered them to the city, its magic the only remaining flicker of warmth. And so they stayed, and life went on. Those who had not yet fallen victim to the gnawing hunger for magic went about their daily work and minded their own, and did their best to forget about the slow way their world was dying. Many clung to the belief that the magic would return, that a strong enough ruler would be able to force the power back into the veins of the world and revive it. And so they waited. Kell wondered if the people of White London truly believed that Astrid and Athos Dane were strong enough, or if they were simply waiting for the next magician to rise up and overthrow them. Which someone would, eventually. Someone always did. The quiet got heavier as the castle came into sight. Grey and Red London both had palaces for their rulers. White London had a fortress. A high wall surrounded the castle, and between the vaulting citadel and its outer wall stood an expansive stone courtyard, running like a moat around the looming structure and brimming with marble forms. The infamous Cruz Meaict, the stone forest, was made up not of trees but of statues, all of them people. It was rumoured the figures hadn't always been stone, that the forest was actually a graveyard kept by the Danes to commemorate those they killed and remind any who passed through the outer wall of what happened to traitors in the Twins' London. Passing under the entryway and through the courtyard, Kell approached the massive stone steps. 10 guards flanked the stairs of the fortress, still as the statues in the forest. They were nothing but puppets, stripped by King Athos of everything but the breath in their lungs and the blood in their veins and his order in their ears. The sight of them made Kell shiver. In Red London, using magic to control, possess, or bind the body and mind of another person was forbidden. Here, it was yet another sign of Athos and Astrid's strength, their might, and therefore right, to rule. The guard stood motionless. Only their empty eyes followed him as he approached and passed through the heavy doors. Beyond, more guards lined the walls of an arching antechamber, still as stones save for their shifting gazes. Kell crossed the room and into a second corridor, this one empty. It wasn't until the doors closed behind him that Kell let himself exhale and lower his guard a fraction.
"I wouldn't do that just yet," said a voice from the shadows.
A moment later a shape stepped out of them. Torches lined the walls, burning but never burning out, and in their flickering light Kell saw the man. Holland. The Antari's skin was nearly colourless, and charcoal hair swept across his forehead, ending just above his eyes. One of them was a greyish-green, but the other was glossy and black. And when that eye met Kell's, it felt like two stones sparking against each other.
"I've come with a letter," said Kell.
"Have you?" Holland said dryly. "I thought you'd come for tea."
"Well, I'll take that too, I suppose, while I'm here."
Holland's mouth quirked in something that wasn't a smile.
"Athos or Astrid?"
he asked as if it were a riddle. But riddles had right answers, and when it came to the Dane twins there was none. Kell could never decide which one he would rather face. He didn't trust the siblings not together, and certainly not apart.
"Astrid," he said, wondering if he'd chosen well.
Holland gave no indication, only nodded and led the way. The castle was built like a church, and maybe it had been one once, its skeleton vast and hollow. Wind whistled through the halls, and their steps echoed over the stone. Well, Kell's steps did. Holland moved with the terrifying grace of a predator. A white half-cloak draped over one of his shoulders, billowing behind him as he walked. It was held together by a clasp, a silver circular brooch etched with markings that at a distance looked like nothing more than decoration. But Kell knew the story of Holland and the silver clasp. He hadn't heard it from the Antari's lips, of course, but had bought the truth off a man at the Scorched Bone, traded the full story for a Red London Lynn several years before. He couldn't understand why Holland, arguably the most powerful person in the city and perhaps the world, would serve a pair of glorified cutthroats like Astrid and Athos. Kell had himself been to the city a handful of times before the last king fell, and he had seen Holland at the ruler's side. But as an ally, not a servant. He had been different then. Younger and more arrogant, yes, but there was also something else. Something more. A light in his eyes. A fire. And then, between one visit and the next, the fire was gone, and so was the king, replaced by the Danes. Holland was still there, at their side, as if nothing had changed. But he had changed, gone cold and dark, and Kell wanted to know what had happened, what had really happened. So he went looking for an answer, and he found it, as he found most things, and most found him, in the tavern that never moved. Here it was called the Scorched Bone. The storyteller clutched the coin as if for warmth as he hunched on his stool and spun the tale in Mactan, the guttural native tongue of the harsh city.
"On vair talk," he began under his breath.
"The story goes.
Our throne is not something you're born to. It's not held by blood, but taken by it. Someone cuts their way to the throne and holds it as long as they can. A year, maybe two, until they fall and someone else rises. Kings come and go. It is a constant cycle. And usually, it is a simple enough matter. The murderer takes the place of the murdered."
7 years ago, the man continued, when the last king was killed, several tried to claim his crown, but in the end it came down to three. Astrid, Athos, and Holland.
Kell's eyes widened. While he knew Holland had served the prior crown, he had not known of his aspirations to be king. Though it made sense, Holland was Antara in a world where power meant everything. He should have been the obvious victor. Still, the Dane twins proved nearly as powerful as they were ruthless and cunning, and together they defeated him. But they didn't kill him. Instead, they bound him. At first, Kell thought he'd misunderstood. His Mactan wasn't as flawless as his Arnesian, and he made the man repeat the word.
"Fuchst. Bound." "It's that clasp," said the man in the scorched bone, tapping his chest. "The silver circle."
It was a binding spell, he explained, and a dark one at that, made by Athos himself. The king had an unnatural gift for controlling others, but the seal didn't make Holland a mindless slave like the guards that lined the castle halls. It didn't make him think or feel or want. It only made him do.
"The Pale King is clever," added the man, fiddling with his coin. "Terrible, but clever."
Holland stopped abruptly, and Kell forced his mind and his gaze back to the castle hall and the door that now waited in front of them. He watched as the white Antari brought his hand to the door where a circle of symbols was burned into the wood. He drew his fingers deftly across them, touching four in sequence. A lock yielded within, and he led Kell through. The throne room was just as sprawling and hollow as the rest of the castle, but it was circular and made of brilliant white stone, from the rounded walls and the arching ribs of the ceiling to the glittering floors and the twin thrones on the raised platform in its centre. Kell shivered despite the fact the room wasn't cold. It only looked like ice. He felt Holland slip away, but did not turn his attention from the throne or the woman sitting on it. Astrid Dane would have blended right in if it weren't for her veins. They stood out like dark threads on her hands and at her temples. The rest of her was a study in white. So many tried to hide the fact they were fading, covering their skin or painting it up to look healthier. The Queen of White London did not. Her long, colourless hair was woven back into a braid, and her porcelain skin bled straight into the edges of her tunic. Her entire outfit was fitted to her like armour. The collar of her shirt was high and rigid, guarding her throat, and the tunic itself ran from chin to wrist to waist, less out of a sense of modesty, Kell was sure, than protection. Below a gleaming silver belt, she wore fitted pants that tapered into tall boots. Rumour had it that a man once spat at her for refusing to wear a dress. She'd cut off his lips. The only bits of colour were the pale blue of her eyes and the greens and reds of the talismans that hung from her neck and wrists and were threaded through her hair. Astrid had draped herself over one of the two thrones, her long, thin body like taut wire under her clothes, sinewy but far from weak. She fiddled with a pendant at her neck, its surface like frosted glass, its edges as red as freshly drawn blood. Strange, thought Kell, to see something so bright in white London.
"I smell something sweet," she said.
She'd been gazing up at the ceiling. Now her eyes wandered down and landed on Kell.
"Hello, flower boy."
The Queen spoke in English. Kell knew that she hadn't studied the language, that she, like Athos, relied on spell work instead. Somewhere under her close-fitting clothes a translation rune was scarred into her skin. Unlike the desperate tattoos made by the power-hungry, the language rune was a soldier's response to a politician's problem. Red London treated English as a mark of high society, but White London found little use for it. Holland had told Kell once that this was a land of warriors, not diplomats. They valued battle more than ballrooms, and saw no value in a tongue that their own people did not understand. Rather than waste years learning the common tongue between kings, those who took the throne simply took the rune as well. "Your Majesty," said Kell. The Queen drew herself up into a sitting position. The laziness of her motions was a farce. Astrid Dane was a serpent, slow only until she chose to strike.
"Come closer," she said. "Let me see how you've grown."
"I've been grown for some time," said Kell.
She drew a nail down the arm of the throne.
"Yet you do not fade."
"Not yet,"
he said, managing a guarded smile.
"Come to me,"
she said again, holding out her hand,
"or I will come to you."
Kell was not sure if it was a promise or a threat, but he had no choice regardless, and so he stepped forward into the serpent's nest. 3. The whip cracked through the air, the forked end splitting open the skin of the boy's back. He did not scream. Athos wished he would, but a gasp of pain whistled through his clenched teeth. The boy was pinned against a square metal frame like a moth, his arms spread wide, wrists bound to each of the two vertical bars that formed the square's sides. His head hung forward, sweat and blood trickling down the lines of his face, dripping from his chin. The boy was 16, and he had not bowed. Athos and Astrid had ridden through the streets of White London on their pale steeds, surrounded by their empty-eyed soldiers, relishing the fear in their people's eyes and, with it, their obedience. Knees hit stone, heads bowed low. But one boy, Athos later learned his name was Belloc, the word coughed through bloody lips, stood there, his head barely tipped forward. The eyes of the crowd had gone to him, a visceral ripple rolling through them. Shock, yes, but underneath it, amazement bordering on approval. Athos had pulled his horse to a stop and gazed down at the boy, considering his moment of stubborn youthful defiance. Athos had been a boy once, of course. He had done foolish, headstrong things, but he had learned many lessons in the struggle for the white crown and many more since taking it as his own. And he knew above all that defiance was like a weed, something to be ripped out at the roots. On her steed his sister watched, amused, as Athos tossed a coin to the boy's mother, who stood beside him.
"Ot vos reike," he said, "for your loss."
That night the empty-eyed soldiers came, broke down the doors of Belloc's small house, and dragged the boy kicking and screaming and hooded into the street. His mother, held back by a spell scrawled across the stone walls, unable to do anything but wail. The soldiers dragged the boy all the way to the palace and delivered him, bloody and beaten, to the glittering white floor in front of Athos's throne.
"Look at this," Athos chided his men. "You've hurt him."
The king stood and looked down at the boy.
"That's my job."
Now the whip split air and flesh again, and this time, at last, Belloc screamed. The whip cascaded from Athos's palm like liquid silver pooling on the ground beside his boot. He began to coil it around his hand.
"Do you know what I see in you?"
He wound the silver rope and slid it into a holster at his waist.
"A fire!"
Belloc spit blood on the floor between them. Athos's lips twisted. He strode across the chamber, caught hold of the boy's face by his jaw, and slammed his head back against the wood of the frame. Belloc groaned in pain, the sound muffled by Athos's hand over his mouth. The king brought his lips to the boy's ear.
"It burns through you,"
he whispered against the boy's cheek.
"I cannot wait to carve it out."
"No Cain avost,"
growled Belloc when the king's hand fell away. "I don't fear death."
"I believe you," said Athos smoothly. "But I'm not going to kill you, though I'm sure," he added, turning away, "you'll wish I had."
A stone table stood nearby. On it sat a metal chalice filled with ink, and beside it a very sharp blade. Athos took up both and brought them to Belloc's pinned body. The boy's eyes widened as he realized what was about to happen, and he tried to fight against his binds, but they did not give. Athos smiled.
"You have heard, then, about the marks I make?"
The whole city knew of Athos's penchant and his prowess for binding spells. Marks that stripped away a person's freedom, their identity, their soul. Athos took his time readying the knife, letting the boy's fear fill the room as he swirled the metal through the ink, coating it. The length of the blade was grooved, the ink filling the notch as if it were a pen. When it was ready, the king drew the stained knife out, the gesture seductively slow, cruel. He smiled and brought the tip to the boy's heaving chest.
"I'm going to let you keep your mind," said Athos. "Do you know why?"
The blade's tip bit in and Belloc gasped.
"So I can watch the war play in your eyes every time your body obeys my will instead of yours."
Athos pressed down and Belloc bit back a scream as the knife carved its way across his flesh, down his collar, over his heart. Athos whispered something low and constant as he drew the lines of the binding spell. Skin broke, and blood welled and spilled into the blade's path. But Athos seemed unbothered, his eyes half closed as he guided the knife. When it was over, he set the blade aside and stepped back to admire his work. Belloc was slumped against his binds, chest heaving. Blood and ink ran down his skin.
"Stand up straight,"
commanded Athos, satisfaction washing over him, as he watched Belloc try to resist, his muscles shuddering against the instruction before giving in and dragging his wounded body up into a semblance of posture. Hatred burned through the boy's eyes, bright as ever, but his body now belonged to Athos.
"What is it?" asked the king.
The question wasn't directed at the boy, but at Holland, who had appeared in the doorway. The Antares' eyes slid over the scene, the blood, the ink, the tortured commoner, his expression lodged between distant surprise and disinterest, as if the sight meant nothing to him. Which was a lie. Holland liked to play at being hollow, but Athos knew it was a ruse. He may feign numbness, but he was hardly immune to sensation, to pain.
"Was Wotach?"
asked Holland, nodding at Belloc. "Are you busy?"
"No,"
answered Athos, wiping his hands on a dark cloth.
"I think we're done for now."
"What is it?" "He is here."
"I see,"
said Athos, setting aside the towel. His white cloak hung on a chair, and he took it up and slung it around his shoulders in one fluid motion, fastening the clasp at his throat.
"Where is he now?"
"I delivered him to your sister."
"Well, then," said Athos, "let's hope we're not too late."
Athos turned toward the door, but as he did, he caught Holland's gaze wandering back to the boy strapped against the metal frame.
"What should I do with him?"
he asked.
"Nothing,"
said Athos.
"He'll still be here when I get back."
Holland nodded, but before he could turn to go, Athos brought a hand to his cheek. Holland did not pull away, did not even stiffen under the king's touch.
"Jealous?"
he asked. Holland's two-toned eyes held Athos's, the green and the black, both steady, unblinking.
"He suffered," added Athos softly, "but not like you."
He brought his mouth closer.
"No one suffers as beautifully as you."
There it was in the corner of Holland's mouth, the crease of his eye. Anger, pain, defiance. Athos smiled, victorious.
"We'd better go," he said, hand falling away, "before Astrid swallows our young guest whole."
4. Astrid beckoned. Kell wished he could set the letter on the narrow table that sat between the thrones and go, keep his distance. But the queen sat there holding out her hand for it. For him. He drew King Maxim's letter from his pocket and offered it to her, but when she reached to take it, her hand slid past the paper and closed around his wrist. He pulled back on instinct, but her grip only tightened. The rings on her fingers glowed, and the air crackled as she mouthed a word, and lightning danced up Kell's arm, followed almost instantly by pain. The letter tumbled from his hand as the magic in his blood surged forward, willing him to act, to react. But he fought the urge. It was a game, Astrid's game. She wanted him to fight back, so he willed himself not to, even when her power, the closest thing to an element she could summon, something sharp, electric and unnatural, forced a leg to buckle beneath him.
"I like it when you kneel,"
she said softly, letting go of his wrist. Kell pressed his hands flat against the cool stone floor and took a shaky breath. Astrid swiped the letter from the ground and set it on the table before sinking back into her throne.
"I should keep you,"
she added, tapping a finger thoughtfully against the pendant that hung from her throat. Kell rose slowly to his feet. An aching pain rolled up his arm in the energy's wake.
"Why's that?"
he asked. Her hand fell from the charm.
"Because I do not like things that don't belong to me," she said. "I do not trust them." "Do you trust anything?"
he countered, rubbing his wrist. "Or anyone, for that matter?" The queen considered him, her pale lips curling at the edges.
"The bodies in my floor all trusted someone. Now I walk on them to tea."
Kell's gaze drifted down to the granite beneath his feet. There were rumours, of course, about the bits of duller white that studded the stone. Just then the door swung open behind him, and Kell turned to see King Athos striding in, Holland trailing several steps behind. Athos was a reflection of his sister, only faintly distorted by his broader shoulders and shorter hair. But everything else about him, from complexion to wiry muscle, to the wanton cruelty they shared, was an exact replica.
"I heard we had company," he said cheerfully.
"Your Highness," said Kell with a nod, "I was just leaving."
"Already?" said the King. "Stay and have a drink."
Kell hesitated. Turning down the Prince Regent's invitation was one thing, turning down Athos Dane's was quite another. Athos smiled at his indecision.
"Look at how he worries, sister."
Kell did not realize she had risen from her seat until he felt her there beside him, running a finger down the silver buttons of his coat. And Tarai or not, the Danes made him feel like a mouse in the company of snakes. He willed himself not to pull away from the Queen's touch a second time, lest it provoke her.
"I want to keep him, brother," said Astrid.
"I fear our neighbouring crown would not be pleased," said Athos. "But he'll stay for a drink, won't you, Master Kell?"
Kell felt himself nodding slowly, and Athos's smile spread, teeth glinting like knife points.
"Splendid!"
He snapped his fingers and a servant appeared, turning his dead eyes up to his master.
"A chair,"
ordered Athos, and the servant fetched one and set it behind Kell's knees before retreating, quiet as a ghost.
"Sit,"
commanded Athos. Kell did not. He watched the King ascend the dais and approach the table between the thrones. On it sat a decanter of golden liquid and two empty glass goblets. Athos lifted one of the glasses, but did not pour from the decanter. Instead, he turned toward Holland.
"Come here."
The other Anne Tyrai had retreated to the far wall, fading into it despite the near black of his hair and the true black of his eye. Now he came forward with his slow and silent steps. When he reached Athos, the King held out the empty goblet and said,
"Cut yourself."
Kell's stomach turned. Holland's fingers drifted for an instant toward the clasp at his shoulder before making their way to his exposed side of his half-cloak. He rolled up his sleeve, revealing the tracery of his veins, but also a mess of scars. And Tarai healed faster than most. The cuts must have been deep. He drew a knife from his belt and raised arm and blade both over the goblet.
"Your Majesty," said Kell hastily, "I have no taste for blood. Could I trouble you for something else?"
"Of course," said Athos lightly. "It's no trouble at all."
Kell was halfway through a shaky sigh of relief when Athos turned back to Holland, who'd begun to lower his arm. The King frowned.
"I thought I said cut."
Kell cringed as Holland raised his arm over the goblet and drew the knife across his skin. The cut was shallow, a graze, just deep enough to draw blood. It welled and spilled in a thin ribbon into the glass. Athos smiled and held Holland's gaze.
"We haven't got all night," he said. "Press down harder."
Holland's jaw clenched, but did it as he was told. The knife bit into his arm deep, and the blood flowed a rich dark red into the glass. When the goblet was full, Athos passed it to his sister and ran a finger along Holland's cheek.
"Go clean up,"
he said softly, gently, the way a parent would to a child. Holland withdrew, and Kell realized that he'd not only taken his seat, but was now gripping the arms of his chair with whitening knuckles. He forced his fingers free as Athos plucked the second glass from the table and poured the pale gold liquid into it. He held it up for Kell to see, then drank to show the glass and contents alike were safe, before pouring a new measure and offering it to Kell. The gesture of a man used to sabotage. Kell took the glass and drank too fast and too deep in an effort to calm his nerves. As soon as the goblet was empty, Athos filled it again. The drink itself was light and sweet and strong and went down easily. Meanwhile, the Danes shared their cup, Holland's blood turning their lips a vibrant red as they drank. "Power lies in the blood," thought Kell, as his own began to warm.
"It's amazing,"
he said, forcing himself to drink his second portion slower than his first.
"What is?"
asked Athos, sinking into his throne. Kell nodded at the goblet of Holland's blood.
"That you managed to keep your clothes so white."
He finished his second glass, and Astrid laughed and poured him a third. 5. Kell should have stopped at one drink, or two. He thought he'd stopped at three, but he couldn't be entirely sure. He hadn't felt the full effects of the drink until he'd gotten to his feet and the white stone floor had tilted dangerously beneath him. Kell knew that it was foolish drinking as much as he had, but the sight of Holland's blood had rattled him. He couldn't get the Antari's expression out of his mind, the look that crossed his face just before the knife bit down. Holland's visage was a perpetual mask of menacing calm, but just for an instant it had cracked. And Kell had done nothing, had not pleaded or even pressed for Athos to yield. It wouldn't have done any good, but still. They were both Antari. Luck alone cast Holland here in ruthless white and Kell in vibrant red. What if their fortunes had been reversed? Kell took a shaky breath, the air fogging before his lips. The cold was doing little to clear his head, but he knew he couldn't go home, not yet, not like this. So he made his wandering way through the streets of white London. This, too, was foolish. Reckless. He was always being reckless. Why? He thought, suddenly angry at himself. Why did he always do this? Step out of safety and into shadow, into risk, into danger. Why? He heard Rye begging on the roof that night. He didn't know. He wished he did, but he didn't. All he knew was that he wanted to stop. The anger bled away, leaving something warm and steady, or maybe that was the drink. It had been a good drink, whatever it was. A strong drink, but not the kind of strong that made you weak. No, no, the kind of strong that made you strong, that made your blood sing, that made... Kell tipped his chin to look at the sky and nearly lost his balance. He needed to focus. He was fairly sure he was heading in the general direction of the river. The air was biting against his lips, and it was getting dark. When had the sun gone down? And in the dregs of light the city was starting to stir around him. Silence, cracking into noise.
"Pretty thing,"
whispered an old woman from a doorway in Mactan.
"Pretty skin, pretty bones."
"This way, master,"
called another.
"Come inside. Rest your feet. Rest your bones. Pretty bones. Pretty blood. Drink your magic. Eat your life. Come inside."
Kell tried to focus, but he couldn't seem to hold his thoughts together. As soon as he managed to gather a few, a breeze would blow through his head and scatter them, leaving him dazed and a little dizzy. Danger prickled at the edge of his senses. He closed his eyes, but every time he did, he saw Holland's blood running into the glass, so he forced them open and looked up. He hadn't meant to head for the tavern. His feet had set out on their own. His body had made its way. Now he found himself staring at the sign over the door of the Scorched Bone. Despite being a fixed point, the tavern in White London didn't feel like the others. It still pulled at him, but the air smelled like blood as well as ash, and the street stones were cold beneath his boots. They tugged at his warmth, his power. His feet tried to carry him forward, but he willed them to stay. "Go home," thought Kell. Rye was right. Nothing good could come of these deals. Nothing good enough. It wasn't worth it. The baubles he traded for, they brought him no peace. It was just a silly game. And it was time to stop. He held on to that thought as he drew the knife from its holster and brought it to his forearm.
"It's you!"
came a voice behind him. Kell turned, the blade sliding back to his side. A woman stood there at the mouth of the alley, her face hidden by the hood of a threadbare blue cloak. If they'd been in any other London, the blue might have been the colour of sapphires or the sea. Here, it was the faintest shade like the sky through layers and layers of clouds.
"Do I know you?"
he asked, squinting into the dark. She shook her head.
"But I know you, Aunt Tarai."
"No, you don't,"
he said with a fair amount of certainty.
"I know what you do when you're not at the castle."
Kell shook his head. "I'm not making deals tonight."
"Please,"
she said, and he realized that she was clutching an envelope.
"I don't want you to bring me anything."
She held out the letter.
"I only want you to take it."
Kell's brow crinkled. "A letter? The worlds have been sealed off from one another for centuries. Who could she be writing to?"
"My family,"
said the woman, reading the question in his eyes.
"Ages ago, when Black London fell and the doors were sealed, we were divided. Over the centuries, our families have tried to keep the thread. But I'm the only one left. Everyone here is dead but myself, and everyone there is dead but one. Olivar. He's the only family I have, and he's on that side of the door, and he's dying, and I just want..."
She brought the letter to her chest.
"We are all that's left."
Kell's head was still swimming.
"How did you even hear," he asked, "that Olivar was ill?"
"The other Aunt Tarai,"
she explained, glancing around as if she feared someone would hear.
"Holland! He brought me a letter."
Kell couldn't picture Holland deigning to smuggle anything between Londons, let alone correspondences between commoners.
"He didn't want to,"
added the woman.
"Olivar gave him everything he had to buy the letter's passage, and even then..."
She brought her hand to her collar as if reaching for a necklace and finding only skin.
"I paid the rest."
Kell frowned. That seemed even less in Holland's nature. Not that he was selfless, but Kell doubted that he was greedy in this way, doubted that he cared about that kind of payment. Then again, everyone had secrets, and Holland wore his so close that Kell was forced to wonder how much he truly knew of the Aunt Tarai's character. The woman thrust out the letter again.
"Niai Shost,"
she said.
"Please, Master Kell."
He tried to focus, to think. He'd promised Rye, but it was only a letter. And technically, under the laws set out by the crowns of all three Londons, letters were a necessary exemption from the rule of no transference. Sure, they only meant letters between the crowns themselves, but still.
"I can pay you in advance,"
she pressed.
"You needn't come back to close the deal. This is the last and only letter. Please."
She dug in her pocket and retrieved a small parcel wrapped in cloth, and before Kell could say yes or no, she pushed the note and payment both into his hands. A strange feeling shot through him as the fabric of the parcel met his skin. And then the woman was pulling away. Kell looked down at the letter and address penned onto the envelope and then to the parcel. He went to unwrap it, and the woman shot forward and caught his hand.
"Don't be a fool,"
she whispered, glancing around the alley.
"They'll cut you for a coin in these parts."
She folded his fingers over the package.
"Not here,"
she warned.
"But it's enough, I swear. It must be."
Her hand slipped away.
"It's all I can give."
Kell frowned down at the object. The mystery of it was tempting, but there were too many questions, too many pieces that didn't make sense, and he looked up and started to refuse. But there was no one to refuse. The woman was gone. He stood there at the mouth of the scorched bone, feeling dazed, What had just happened? He'd finally mustered the resolve to make no deals, and the deal had come to him. He stared down at the letter and the payment, whatever it was.